Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to our Three Ideas in 30 Minutes, a pre-Mincha Maariv edition. And I want to thank our sponsors for this evening. First, the LF family sponsoring in honor of or a memory of Michael's grandfather, Aaron Ben Shlomo Halevi. The learning should be in Aliyah for his neshama. And the learning as well should be in Aliyah for the neshama. My grandmother, who's Yurtzai with this past week, Rivka Bas Rav Avraham Mordechai. Our learning should be for her neshama. And of course, as always, our learning should be in Aliyah for the neshama of Esther Tila Bas Gavriel Pinchas. Okay, this week's Parsha, Parshas Noach. So we're going to get to actually Noach at the end, because that's usually what people speak about first. First, we're going to speak a little bit about the Teva. And the Pasuk very famously says, Sohar Tase La Teva, that it's supposed to have a Tsohar. And Rashi over there says that there's a Machlokas, that there are some who say that it's a window, and that there are those who say that it's a rock, that there was a special rock that illuminated light. Now that in and of itself is a very fascinating Machlokas, maybe one in which we'll get to in a minute. But nonetheless, the Rav Menachem Ben Zion Sachs has a beautiful little piece on this idea of Tzohar Tase L'Teva. He writes here the following, page number one. Kriya Zos Mechuvenes L'Chol Yad Yehudi Ba'asher Husham. This notion of that your Teva has to have a window is a call to every single Jew. And that call is, Al Tia Shakua Rak Becha Uvigor Alecha. Don't be consumed in your own world. In other words, don't just think about yourself, but rather, Pasach L'Cha Chalon Roa Chotz. Everyone has to have a window that they're also looking outside. Hashkef mimoncha batuach hametsuyad b'chol atov. Look outside of your place that is secure and equipped with all goodness. El gehenim haloid bo nesunim achicha, to the fiery hell that your brothers find themselves in. Umitzvuncha yinkof ez libcha v'Yisrael oscha, and it should pierce your conscience, should pierce your heart. And it should give you mussar. And it should say to you, Lama umadua hitstamata lisalechi malokim toch dalad amo shelcha. Why are you content walking with Hashem in your dalad amos? In other words, just in your vicinity. Velo isalachta lifnei elokim. But you're not walking before God. Lios ose umase latzolos achecha b'nei Yisrael nesum etzar v'shivya, to be working on behalf of the Jewish people. Therefore, says Rav Menachem Ben Zion Sachs, this entire pasuk, what is it communicating to us? It's communicating to us a hashkafas achayim, an approach to life. He says it's not enough just to be content and comfortable and secure in your own surroundings. It's not enough to just build walls and to protect yourself. He says, but rather your teva has to have windows. You have to look out onto the world and you have to see the suffering of other people. Not to walk with Hashem, notice he uses this play on language, but rather to walk before Hashem. In other words, that's what Hashem wants from us in this world. Hashem wants us to walk before Him and to care about other people. He says quotes the Gemara Brachos, Al Yisbalel Adam Ela Babayis Shiyesh Sham Chalonos, that a person should only daven in a place that has windows. Why is that the case? Why do you have to daven in a place that has windows? We have natural light. We have beautiful natural light. So what do I care if there are windows in here or not windows in here? He says that's the whole point, that when you're davening, it's not just enough to think about yourself, and it's not just enough to think about your own needs, but when I look out the windows, I realize there's an entire world out there, a world that he describes as El Gehenim Haloid Bo, like a fiery hell that's burning, or the language that we use in this week's Parsha is a storming range out, a raging storm out there that is consuming the world. And therefore, the windows remind us not just to think about ourselves, but to think of other people as well. He continues by saying, Ason ha'olam hu, the disaster of the world is, she'anashim ha'yoshim betach, that there are people who sit and they're secure and they feel safe, makifim atzmam bire'eyu mechitzos, sheroim rak es atzmam v'lo yoser, and they surround themselves with mirrors and with boundaries where the only thing that they see is themselves. So I come into Shmon Esrei and I think about my needs. And I come to Shema Koleinu and I think about my family. It's like a mirror. All I do is I look at myself. But he said in Judaism, we don't look at mirrors. What do? We look at windows. Because a mirror is only a reflection of myself. That only focuses on my needs. But a window encourages me to look at everybody else, to remember that there's a world around me. He says, Anochiut, that sense of self-centeredness or narcissism, ubidud me'anashim acherim, in separating myself from other people, mihovim sakana gedola. He said that is an extreme amount of danger to the Jewish people. And so we have here, I think beautifully, tsoar ta'aseh l'tevah. What did Noach need a window for? He needed light? Okay, I'm sure Hashem created a miracle where all the animals fit in a very small teva. If you actually figure out the dimensions of the teva, it was very small. If Hashem figured out that miracle, he would have figured out some electric system within the teva as well. Noach didn't need it for the light. What Hashem was telling him is, don't think that just because you're in the teva, you are safe and secure, and therefore you can ignore the world around you. But rather, he says, your job is to care about other people as well. That's why our shuls, the Gemara in Brachos tells us, has windows, so that I don't just look in a mirror. It's not just about me, but it's about looking out and reminding myself that there's a world out there. I'll share with you where else we see this, and that is in the contrast between the Mishkan and the Mikdash. A very beautiful piece here from Rabbi Alex Israel in his Sefer on Malachim. There, he points out the Kruvim. So we know that the Kruvim sat in the Mishkan and the Mikdash. You don't have this, right? That the Kruvim. And the Gemara already cites a discrepancy as to which direction the Kruvim faced. So for example, in Sefer Shmos, it says that they faces towards each other. Then when it comes time for Shlomo to designate the Beis HaMikdash, it doesn't say they faced together, but rather it says they faced outward towards the walls of the Beis HaMikdash. Now we know the Gemara Baba Basra tells us that what does this mean? Bizman she'osim ratzon Hashem makom, when we do the ratzon of Hashem, then the Kruvim are facing each other. When we're not doing it, that's when they're facing opposite. Rabbi Alex Israel wanted to say differently. He said we might suggest a different possibility, that the Kruvim of the Mishkan in the Mikdash actually functioned differently. In the Mishkan, in other words, the one that was described in Sefer Shmos, the Kruvim faced one another, whereas in Shlomo's Beis HaMikdash, the Kruvim are facing towards the walls or towards outwards. This shift in facial orientation of the Kruvim may hint to a deeper shift in the texture of Shlomo's Beis HaMikdash. The Mishkan, was essentially internally directed, intended for the service within the Jewish people. Right? We were in the desert. There was no one else around us. It was just about us in cultivating and creating a relationship with Hashem. However, in contrast, the Kruvim of Shlomo HaMelech, the vehicles of the Shekhinah, were directed in an outwards trajectory. Like the Beis HaMikdash, they faced the outside world. The Mikdash aimed to make an impression on a wider population, to spread the name of God beyond the Jewish people. And so the Kruvim are a representation of this as well. The Kruvim and the Beis HaMikdash were not faced together, but rather they were faced outwards. We just said it a number of times. We said, Ki Beisi Beis Tvilai Karei L'chol Amim. The Beis HaMikdash wasn't just for the Jewish people in an insular sense, but rather the Beis HaMikdash was a place that was supposed to radiate a sense of Kedusha. That's why the Gemara describes that the windows of the Beis HaMikdash were wide on the outside and narrow on the inside. Why? Because it was not supposed to, did I get that right, the description? Whichever way I just described it, it's not to let light in from the inside, but rather it's to radiate light outside. And so they weren't just normal windows, but they were curved in a specific way to indicate that they weren't there for the light, but rather they were there to take whatever light was inside and to magnify and to illuminate and to radiate outwards. And so idea number one comes from Rav Menachem ben Zion Sachs. Soar ta'aseh l'teva. Why did Noach need the window? Did he need light? Certainly Hashem could have created a miracle. No, really what Hashem was reminding him is, Noach, don't you think that just because you're safe and secure, don't you think that just because you are surrounded by a teva, that therefore you can ignore the needs of the Jewish people, that you can ignore the pain and the suffering or the storm that's raging around you? But so are, it has to have a window. You have to be looking out. And that's again why our shuls have windows. Al yispalel adam ela b'bayis sheyesh sham chalonos, that we have to daven in a place with windows. Again, a reminder to us that we don't look at mirrors, or a mirror is only about me. But a window allows me to see other people. And lastly, this idea about the Mikdash, that the Kruvim, he writes, were facing outwards, because that's ultimately what the Mikdash was there. It was facing the outside world to make an impression on the wider population. That's our job as Jews, is to not just care about ourselves, but to care about society and the world around us as well. That is idea number one. Idea number two comes from the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim points out Nimrod. Now, we've spoken about Nimrod in the past. I think we spoke about it 2 years ago, maybe even last year. But Nimrod is a very peculiar figure in the Torah. The Torah seems to describe him in very loving terms, right? Refers to him as Lifnei Hashem, always being before God. And yet, we know that Nimrod, Hu Heichel Lios Gibor Said, he was a hunter, but we also know that he was rebellious. And that's what Rashi tells us here, where I have my arrow on page number 2. Rashi says, Gibor Said, that he was a strong person. Tsa Daitan Shel Brios Befiv, Umatan Limrod Bimakom. That Nimrod wasn't just powerful in strength, but he had a power of persuasion. He was able to use his power of words to convince people of things. And what did he convince people to do? Not good things, but rather he convinced people to do bad things. And therefore, that seems to create a certain ambiguity around Nimrod. The psukim themselves are somewhat innocuous. Chazal come along and say that whatever capacities Nimrod had, he used them for a negative way. He had this koach adibor, he had this koach of speech, but what did he use it for? Tzadaitan, he convinced people to do the wrong thing. Hey, now we know. Oh, we'll get to it in a second. But then, if you look in the next pasuk says, Mina aretz ahi yatsa Ashur, that from that land, Ashur emerged. That's the very next pasuk in the Torah. And if you look at Rashi over there, says the Chafetz Chaim, he writes, Kevan shara Ashur es banav shomim le-Nimrod, when Ashur saw that his children were being convinced by Nimrod, so what did he do? Umordin b'makom, and therefore they were rebelling against Hashem. So what did he do? Yatza mitocham. Ashur got his children as far away from Nimrod as possible. Says the Chafetz Chaim, the Torah doesn't waste words, and the Torah is not coincidental. The positioning of psukim isn't a coincidence. And therefore it must be that if one pasuk comes right after the other, that there's a connection between the two of them. So now he says, let's put the two psukim together. Pasuk number 1 is the Torah telling us that Nimrod had this power of persuasion. Nimrod was so convincing with his words that people listened to him. There was one problem. What did he convince people to do? The wrong thing. Then the next pasuk comes along and says, you know what Ashur did? Ashur saw that Nimrod was convincing their children to do the wrong thing. And so he said, get out of here. Get out of here. Says the Chafetz Chaim something so powerful. And you could take with it what you want. You could take with it what you want. But I think there's a lot to take with it. He says, this is very much, now again, the Chafetz Chaim is writing 100 years ago. I don't think the Chafetz Chaim could have imagined the times that we are living in. But the Chafetz Chaim writes that you see that very same thing in our generation as well. He says, I'm on page number 3. We know Nimrods in our generation. We know people. We know people that are so persuasive with their words and so convincing with their words, and yet people follow them. People blindly follow them. You have charismatic, persuasive people who say things. They could be bombastic, they could be irrational, they could be fake, it could be whatever. But we live in a world where what's true and false is no longer clear. And you have people that are able, with an extreme power of persuasion, right? There was just a debate last night in New York City where truth was, you know, malleable as well. And you have people who are very, very dangerous who say one thing, but who knows what their intentions are. So he says, you have people who use that same power of words, who have the same power of persuasion, and they don't use it. They don't use it for good. He says in the next paragraph, Vine Maisa Nimrod Hayaba Elef Hasheni Librios Olam. Nimrod was thousands of years ago. Vigila Lanu Hakasuv Atidus. But the Torah is telling us about the future. Shebemeshech Hazman, that there's going to come a time. Listen to the words of the Chafetz Chaim. Yimsu Od Kamar Rishoim. There are going to be other people. Shiritzonim Yeh Limrod B'makom V'lasos Eitzus V'tachbulos Eich Lahatosis Abrios Lasur Me'achari Hashem. And they're going to convince people of things. They're going to convince people of illogical things like, anti-Zionism isn't anti-Semitism, right? And they're going to be very persuasive people that are going to get up, 50 years ago it was at the UN. Last night it was at a Democrat, a debate in New York City. And they're going to say, I love Jews, but I hate Zionism. And they're going to go on the pages of the New York Times and other publications, and they're going to say, we love Israel, but we're going to continue to bash it. And they're going to persuade people of this wickedness. And eventually, people are going to come along and be like, yeah, they're wicked. But along the way, who are they going to convince? They're going to convince everybody else. And therefore, he says, that's the danger of Nimrod. The Chafetz Chaim says there's every generation going to be a Nimrod. It was Hitler who used his power of speech before he had the actual power to convince people, right? The herd mentality that was required to convince an entire nation to follow and to murder people. I mean, think about that. The power that certain people have with words. And I think we're seeing that again nowadays. But then the Chafetz Chaim says on page number 4, he says, however, Kashem Shematzinu Gami Nimrod, Sheyatza Ashur, V'Yisrachik Mimenu. But what do we see? That even in the time of Nimrod, there was one person who said, this doesn't sound right. And this is dangerous. And he gets his family out of there. And he calls Nimrod out for it. Kein Adavar Binyanenu. So too it's going to be in our generation. She'aleinu L'Yisrachik Mehem L'Yischazik B'Torasenu HaKadosha. In our generation also, we're going to rely on people that are going to have to stand up and sometimes speak truth to power, and sometimes say things that are going to be unpopular. But the same way Ashur stood up to Nimrod and got away from Nimrod because he understood the danger that he presented, so too, he says, in every generation, we're going to have to do that as well. And if you think about it, that more than anything is the calling card of the Jewish people. Think about every single generation. In every single generation where an evil, wicked person came up and tried to destroy the Jewish people, there was always a Jew or a few Jews who stood up and changed the tide. So whether it was Moshe Rabbeinu, Vayar B'Sivlosa, Moshe Rabbeinu sees all of society and culture tolerating one thing, and Moshe goes out of the palace and he says, this isn't okay. Whether you go all the way to the times of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, when if you just picture it, millions and millions of people are bowing down to a Nebuchadnezzar, a statue of Nebuchadnezzar, and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah say, we're not doing it. And Nebuchadnezzar stops the whole proceeding. Millions of people are bowing down. Three people aren't. And he says, if you don't bow down, I'm killing you all. And you know what they say? They say, we're not doing it. And the Gemara describes, maybe they could have bowed down. It wasn't really Avodah Zarah. But you know what? It was three people who said, just because everyone's doing one thing doesn't mean it's the right thing. And they stood up. And they sacrificed for it. And they were rewarded for it. You have that in the time of Mordechai and Esther. You have it in the time of the Chashmonaim. You have it in the time of recently with the refuseniks in Russia, Sharansky and all those great refuseniks. Every generation of the Jewish people, if you think about it, what defines those generations, on the one hand is the wicked people, but just as equal was that in every generation there were Jews who stood up and said, we are not tolerating this. And they were unpopular. The Gemara tells us that Mordechai at the end of the Purim story wasn't very popular because my guess is most Jews at the time did not like what Mordechai was doing. Most Jews at the time would probably have told Mordechai, just what do you have to be so like Jewish for? Just sit on the side. Or just like let Haman, you know, maybe if we invite Haman to our sukkah, then he'll start liking us and he won't hate us as much, right? You know, Mordechai understood that sometimes even you're not going to be popular, you got to stand up. And I challenge you, every single generation, those are just the ones off the top of my head, but I'm guaranteeing you, every single generation, when there was wicked people who used words to convince the world against the Jewish people, there was always one or two Jews that stood up and stood proud and tall and turned the tide on behalf of the Jewish people. That, says the Chafetz Chaim, is exactly what happens here. You have someone like Nimrod. Nimrod who, notice the Gemara, that Rashi doesn't describe Nimrod by his physical strength. What did Rashi describe him as? By his ability to persuade people with words. Persuade people with words, says Rashi, is almost more dangerous than physical might. And yet it took someone like Ashur, he says, to say to his kids, we are out of here. Asher says, I'm leaving. Kevan Shira Asher, Sheshomin Lim Nimrod. Asher realized that they were being influenced and impacted. Yatza Misocham, he left, says the Chafetz Chaim. That is a model for us. It is a model for Jewish history of what happens when people use words and the power of persuasion against the Jewish people, and that we have to have the courage and we have to have the determination to be willing to stand up on behalf of what is right. So that is idea number 2. Idea number 1 came from the Menachem Zion Sachs about Sohar Tasa LaTeiva, that you have to have windows. You can't look in a mirror, which is a reflection of yourself, but you have to be willing to look out and to notice the world around you. Idea number two came from the Chafetz Chaim, that Nimrod and Ashur are two paradigms for how we are supposed to behave. That there's always going to be a Nimrod, someone who's going to use speech, but we have to be willing to be like Ashur. We have to be willing to stand up for what is right. The last idea comes from Moshe Lichtenstein in a very, very beautiful essay. Moshe Lichtenstein points out, and this is part of a much broader essay. I cut an excerpt for you. If you think back to Rosh Hashanah, not to give anyone PTSD to the Rosh Hashanah Musaf, the long one. So we had three parts, Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofros. He points out that all of Malchios, up until a certain part of Zichronos, is very heavy. Very heavy. Right? There's the parts of the world being judged. There's the Malchus, like big, heavy words. And he says there's one point in Zichronos where it turns. And that is when the Siddur and the Machzor describes Hashem's love for Noach. And that's the second paragraph you have here. And to Noach was lovingly remembered as you redeemed him with the proclamation of mercy and redemption when he brought the floodwaters to destroy all flesh because of their evil deeds. Therefore did his memory appear before you, Hashem, to increase his progeny. And just as you remembered him for mercy, so too you should remember us for mercy as well. Says R. Lichtenstein, from the moment the latter half of Zichronos is introduced, we find ourselves in a totally different world, the world of divine love and fond memory. So basically he says, all of the Rosh Hashanah Davin pivots when Hashem mentions, or when we reference Hashem's love for Noach. So he asks the very question. Noach is positioned at the very point at which this transformation occurs. And he seems to be the vehicle through which it is brought about. Why is Noach singled out? That is his question. If you are going to pivot from what he calls like the judgment part of Rosh Hashanah Davening to the merciful part of Rosh Hashanah Davening, why specifically is Noach represent that shifting point? And he develops the following idea. First of all, he says that to err is human nature, right? Ein tzadik ba'aretz asher yaseh tov lo yechta. There's no one who doesn't sin. That's what it means to be a human being. No matter how perfect you are, no matter how much you try, you're going to sin. We got to get used to that. We all have our weaknesses. We all have our shortcomings. We all make mistakes. Turn to page number 5, 6 now and listen to what he says, though. He says, thus, Noach can be viewed as an everyman whose heroism lies precisely in the fact that he is not a hero. If you think about it, the first Rashi in the Parsha, which says, Noach tzadik haya bedorosav, Noach was a righteous person. And then Rashi says, well, was he really a righteous person? How much of a righteous person was he? Was he only righteous in that generation, but he wouldn't have been righteous in another generation? Says R. Moshe Lichtenstein, you're missing the point of what makes Noach great. What makes Noach great is how imperfect he was. What makes Noach great was how much of an everyman he was, whose heroism lies precisely in the fact that he's not a hero. It's precisely the fact that Noach is not Avram, that he's not Moshe, that he's not Aaron, that makes Noach so relatable to every single one of us. Says Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, Noach is a positive, honest, well-meaning person with a measure of human weakness who is called upon to save mankind. This is what makes him a limited figure who, lacking the greatness of Avram, Avinu, or Adam, neither leads the way before God nor attempts to be like God. Like the famous story of Zusha, all he wants to be is Noach. He wants to follow God in a normal human fashion. He is an average person. He represents us in our human composition, our normal righteousness. Therefore, says R. Moshe Lichtenstein, if Hashem remember Noach with love, there is hope for us too, since Noach is essentially the same as us. What a beautiful idea. What a beautiful idea. He says, if you think about what made Noach great, it's that he's actually a human being. He's actually just like every single one of us. And so therefore, if Noach could be saved from Hashem, despite all of his fallibility, despite all of the mistakes that he makes, despite all of his human weakness, and yet he is deserving of Hashem's divine mercy, then so too every single one of us. Love and compassion are indeed required. We and Noach are sinners who cannot withstand the scrutiny of absolute justice. Yet Noach's fate is proof that Hashem's mercy will prevail, and he will remember us with love and compassion on the day of judgment. And so therefore, says Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, first of all, I think just a beautiful understanding of Noach. Noach, how he describes as the everyman, whose heroism lies precisely in the fact that he is a hero. In other words, sometimes we think we have to be a tzaddik. We have to be like Avram Avinu. We have to be like Moshe Rabbeinu. No, says Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, we are just like Noach. Noach, who's positive, honest, well-meaning, with a measure of human weakness. Does that not describe all of us? All of us try hard. All of us are well-meaning. All of us generally try to be good. And all of us have a measure of human weakness. That defines pretty much all of us. And therefore, he says, if Noach was deserving of Hashem's divine mercy and love, then so too every single one of us. Says Rav Lichtenstein, now you understand why the entire Musaf on Rosh Hashanah shifts when we come to mentioning Noach. Because Noach is the one who reminds us. Up until that point, you talk about judgment. Up until that point, it's the heaviness of Rosh Hashanah davening. But when we come to Noach, and we remind ourselves that Noach was just like us, that Noach was a tzaddik, he tried to be a tzaddik, but he also had human weakness, that Noach also wasn't perfect the same way we're not perfect, and yet Hashem saved Noach, that's when we shift in the Rosh Hashanah davening to reminding ourselves of Hashem's love and Hashem's mercy. And so therefore, I love this for two reasons. I love this both in the way he describes Noach as an everyman, Noach whose heroism is precisely the fact that he's not a hero, his heroism and the fact that he's positive, honest, well-meaning, but also has human weaknesses, which I think describes all of us. And therefore, if Noach was worthy of that, so too every single one of us. But I think also, it's such a beautiful way to think about the Rosh Hashanah davening. I encourage you to look at the Machzor, to understand and to appreciate exactly where it comes in the davening, but at least the way he positions it and understands it as the turning point in the Musaf, I think is a really beautiful point. I think it's something to think about as we come to this week's Parsha. There are lots of figures in Tanakh that are unrelatable. According to Moshe Lichtenstein, Noach is the most relatable. And therefore, if Noach is the everyman and he's the hero, then so too can each one of us. So we saw three ideas in just under 30 minutes. Idea number one came from Menachem ben Zion Sachs. Tzohar tasa l'teva. Why is it that the ark had a window? What Noah couldn't figure out how to put electricity. He figured out everything else. The answer is that Hashem says it's not enough to build barriers for yourself. You have to see the outside world. You have to see the suffering of other people. You have to see the needs of Klal Yisrael. Idea number two came from the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim who says that in every generation there are going to be Nimrods. In every generation there are going to be people who are going to use words to persuade people to do the wrong thing. Our job is to be those who stand up and speak truth to power and don't allow ourselves to be persuaded by that, to remain with a sense of fidelity to what is right and to the Ratzon of Hashem. That is not easy to do, but if you look at our heroes in every generation of Jewish history, whether it was Moshe, whether it was Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, whether it was Mordechai and Esther, whether it was Natan Sharansky, whether Yosef Mendelovich, I could tell you every single generation, that is what they have done. And the last idea comes from Moshe Lichtenstein about Noach. Noach is the everyday hero, and that's what makes him so great. If Noach was saved, if Noach was worthy of divine love and mercy, so too each and every one of us. I wish you all a good Shabbos.